Good afternoon. How are we doing?
Afternoon.
Good. I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. All right. We will be on the record with our docket number 87414. Mr. Resch, do you wish to retain any time for rebuttal?
Thank you. Good morning. Yes, 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay. As you know, during argument, the clock will be running. When it gets down to 3 minutes, you'll hear the audible ding. You keep going if you want. Reserve the rest of your time, whatever your pleasure is. And then Ms. Rowe and Ms. Abbott, my understanding is you all are going to divide up your time.
Yes.
5 minutes and then, or thereabouts, and then the rest for Ms. Abbott, yes? Okay. All right, Mr. Resch, you can start whenever you're ready.
Thank you so much. May it please the court. I'm Jamie Resch, here on behalf of Ms. Cardenas Garcia, who's also present with us here today. We have an interesting case from the family court for the court here today, but I hope to start with some non-controversial points. We'll try to build up from there. Here's one. Amended pleadings no longer exist. This is a commonplace and longstanding rule. It's part of why we would maybe have an amended complaint that gets replaced, or part of why we might have an amended judgment of conviction that gets replaced, not an additional judgment of conviction. Very basic rule that I hope everyone in here accepts. But in case it was unclear that that applies to judgments of conviction, there's yet another line of longstanding, unbroken precedent by this court and others that holds that vacated judgments of conviction are void. The Tiffy case was newer. It's cited throughout our brief. But this court's decision in Peters says the same thing, and that case is decades old. Federal Circuit cases are cited as well, and those have also held this. And I just want to mention, in researching this, I came across a United States Supreme Court case, Kirchhoff. It's 274 U.S. 220, says the same thing. Withdrawn guilty pleas no longer exist. So we have this long unbroken history of cases throughout the states, throughout Nevada, that say the same thing.
But what do we do with the word ever in this 432B context? It suggests a kind of a broad reading that doesn't consider a subsequent change in status. When the legislature uses the words, if you've ever been convicted, this is a struggle.
Okay.
It's academically for me as well. So I appreciate you walking us through it, but I am concerned about the use of the word ever in the statute.
All right. Well, I'll answer the million-dollar question right now. Here's what the word ever in the statute means. It is a measure of time. It's commonplace in CPS cases that somebody might be arrested for child abuse, and that gives rise to both a criminal case as well as a CPS case. The use of the word ever is there to alert the court that even if the conviction is years old, if a CPS case arises, the presumption would still apply and still has to be dealt with if the conviction is of record. Let me put it another way. Say we took the statute and we're going to go ahead and delete the word ever right now. So it just says has been convicted. I worry that somebody like myself might in a given case come in and say, well, the statute says has been convicted. That means in conjunction with the pending CPS case. So I believe the legislative intent is best read to say, well, no, if you have a conviction, even if it's 20 years old, you're going to have to overcome the presumption. Nothing about the legislative history or the language of the statute suggests that the legislature intended to override these, well, now century of case law that I just discussed that holds that vacated convictions are void. So I think that, I guess I would start with this. My first argument would be, it's not even ambiguous, okay? A statute for it to be ambiguous has to be subject to more than one reasonable interpretation. I would just suggest that the interpretation being provided by the respondents is not reasonable in light of this century's worth of case law. The legislature would presumably have been aware of, maybe not Tiffy because it's newer, but Peters and the circuit cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, all these other cases that say vacated convictions are void. If they had wanted to make it clear that it still applied even when conviction is removed, they certainly could have said so. It's just such a stretch to take the word ever and apply it to that.
Same token, they could have said if a custodial parent is under conviction or has been convicted or has a conviction, as opposed to using that very specific word ever. And I think when you're talking about a statute like this, that's contemplating the return of a child to somebody that's ever had a conviction for felony child abuse, there's a really good public policy argument there, right? About we want to be extra certain that there's no harm that may come to this child if we return them to a parent. And so if you've ever had a conviction like this, we want to be very cognizant of that and make sure that there is some showing to us that there's not a danger to the child.
Sure, thank you. That gives rise to a couple of concerns, which again, number one, this is the agreement that the Clark County District Attorney worked out. Like, if they didn't want to be in this position, they didn't have it. This deal only happened because they agreed to it.
Right.
Drop down deals probably happen, who knows? There were probably a dozen of them this morning in district court right over there, very popular.
Right.
And so the net effect of drop down deals is that conviction doesn't exist anymore. So I would suggest the first order of business is Ms. Cardenas-Garcia is not convicted of child abuse this time, nor was she ever, because that's the fiction that we recognize based on this century's worth of case law.
To that point, do you think it would chill plea negotiations and drop downs if the statute was interpreted to say if you get a drop down, then it no longer applies? There's no concern that the court gets to look at in terms of danger to the child.
I'm honestly stating that I think most people in that courtroom right now, the ones doing these deals every single day, probably take my same view of it. Why else do it? I mean, that's part of the deal of being removed from having a felony on your record, one of the benefits that you get. There's all kinds of drawbacks to felonies on your record who could affect the right to vote, the right to bear arms, and these are not questions before the court. But let me answer your question another way, if I may.
Go ahead.
There's a analog within 432B that we can take a look at, which is the domestic violence presumption. And so that's 157. We see a lot of those in cases too. So somebody's convicted of domestic violence, they have that presumption. Child abuse, they have the 555 presumption. As far as the domestic violence, here's some interesting point on the legislative intent. It is broader. The legislature crafted that statute to say, well, if you're convicted, domestic violence presumption applies. It also goes on to say, well, or if a court finds you committed the acts of domestic violence, the presumption applies. And so, again, the legislature is perfectly capable of, if the public policy is to extend to acts of child abuse, they were perfectly capable of saying that. That's what they did with the 157 presumption. They didn't do it here, which is, in fact, more to my point, that they intended to limit the 555 presumption only to convictions that still exist.
And the district court actually didn't consider this particular issue, right? I mean, I think they declined to reopen the case, even though this arguably new argument was being raised that she's not ever been convicted because of the drop down. I don't know that the district court below substantively considered that argument.
I took that point out of the respondent's brief. I very much disagree with it. I really don't know what else we could have done. I'll give you the quick structure of the case and we can all try to work through it, but we had a presumption hearing, there's no doubt. We didn't overcome it at that time. That's what
but
the judge
said.
But
at that time, she had not yet finished her probation. And
that is true. And so that was months before.
So my question more to the point is, you know, should we just remand it back down to the district court to do the work? Because I don't know that they've ever substantively addressed this issue.
But I would say that they did, because the way that we brought it up was to file what could have been construed as a motion for reconsideration based on her change in circumstance. The plea had been withdrawn. And so that wasn't true at the time that we had the presumption hearing. And it wasn't true at the time the district court ordered that order, entered the original order. But we then went on to specifically raise all these issues that are here before the court today. We're in our motion, strangely titled motion to, you know, determine that the presumption no longer applied. But that factually was what we were asking the court to do based on the fact the conviction had been vacated. So that was squarely the court's decision was no, it says ever in the statute. And so the judge declined to vacate it based on that.
To kind of dovetail off what Justice Lee's question was, so if the district court erred in saying, I can't consider this again because we already did this, or I'm not going to consider it again because we already did this. But let's say she did have discretion to do it again. You would agree that having completed probation, having gone through treatment and successfully completed treatment, would put your client in a much better position and arguably justify the district court taking another look at whether or not clear and convincing evidence showed that there wasn't a danger of harm to the child.
So this court's intervention isn't really needed if the goal is simply to have another 555 here. She can schedule all of those that she wants and show that she's made progress. My concern is, and this was mentioned in our brief, that, you know, I hate to see the bar get set higher than it should be. Parents have a right to custody and control of their kids. That applies even if they're found unfit. They have this presumption that based on, I think, the clear language of the statute, or if it's ambiguous, the interpretation based on that century of case law that say this should not apply, her conviction was vacated. That issue was squarely decided by the judge. Nobody argued below, and the judge did not decide that she didn't have jurisdiction to consider this issue. She simply concluded that as a matter of statutory interpretation, that vacated convictions are covered by 555. And so that's the error that we're asking the court to correct.
And this, you're kind of alluding to this constitutional concern about maybe raising the bar, and you know, people have a constitutional right to raise their kids. I don't know if that was raised below or even up to us.
Well, to be sure, our primary argument is one of statutory interpretation, not looking for some expansive ruling. In fact, I'm urging judicial restraint here today. Decide the cases before you, the 555 presumption, the language of the statute. I think that this court, on an extraordinary petition, is absolutely authorized to determine if the district court erred by misinterpreting a statute. That's our primary argument. I did mention the Constitution only because those rights do exist and they are important. We're certainly not challenging the facial validity of the statute. To some degree, there is a concern that applying it in the way that the district court did would be violative of the Constitution. But that is a complicated argument that we didn't fully develop. And I'm not particularly asking the court to make that finding, other than to note that with the existence of those constitutional rights, that's yet more reason to construe the statute narrowly, because it certainly is an intrusion on that important right that has existed since the time of the nation's founding, to quote the current Supreme Court and how they look at constitutional rights. Those are what they find to be some of the most important ones, unless they're explicitly enumerated in the Constitution. All right, well, with that, I think I will reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal, unless there are any further questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Rowe?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. What you raised earlier is exactly our concern. The word ever. Why did they put the word ever? Our system is designed for the protection of children. We remove children due to abuse and neglect. Our goal is to return them to a safe environment.
So, Ms. Rowe, regardless of this presumption, right, the family court has an obligation to make findings that returning the kids to a parent is in their best interest and the kids are going to be safe, right?
Correct.
So I just don't want this to become like that there's the court is still making those findings. This is just perhaps a technical level above that in terms of this presumption.
Correct.
So if void means it never happened, I mean, we exercise that legal fiction frequently in the law. How do we apply the presumption?
Well, I think the thing is this. Our system is designed for child protection, so we look at that first. They use the word ever. And Mr. Rush says, well, she did have it, but she doesn't have it anymore. But the point is, the definition of ever is at any time.
I think the question is, did she really ever have it if we construe this drop down as voiding that original, like, is it void ab initio almost? I mean, you know what I mean? I think that's what counsel on the other side of the aisle is arguing in cases like Tiffy tend to support that kind of application of the law.
Right. So with this case, this one is somewhat unique. And that's because while the conviction was still there before the drop down, we had a hearing under this presumption in which evidence was presented and the court found she did not overcome the presumption by clear and convincing evidence. And the order from that hearing entered on March 7th, 2023, says that presumption will continue to apply until she demonstrates the behavioral changes necessary to overcome the presumption. So if after that you have someone that gets the conviction set aside, like in this one, it's asking the district court to turn a blind eye not only to the conviction that they are well aware of, but also to the fact that they had an evidentiary hearing in which she could not overcome it. That's very difficult for a court when you're talking about child safety.
Well, I don't think so, though, just for what I said before, right? Because the court still has to make findings. It's in the best interest of the kids. The kids are not going to... the kids are going to be safe, right?
Right.
Regardless. So whether the presumption applies or not, the court still has to engage in all of those findings. It's not like this would be a green light to the return of the child.
Right.
But if the circumstances have changed and a presumption no longer applies, the court has an obligation to look at that, don't they?
Right. But The purpose of 555 is to add the extra layer of protection. When a person has been convicted of child abuse, neglect, endangerment, that's beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the highest burden.
Right, but there's no longer a conviction. So if the legislature had said there's a probable cause determination that the person has committed child abuse or neglect, right? They could have written it that way, and they chose not to. So here, there's no longer a conviction.
And the argument becomes they use the word ever. Right. So, I mean, it's one of those, this is a very difficult, you know, when you're looking at it, very difficult to figure out, because they did use the word ever. And as Justice Hurton has said, they could have just said the word conviction and left it at that, but they didn't.
It didn't seem to me that at any, look, there's a lot of ways to not have a conviction in the future after sustaining it originally, right? There can be a finding that wrongful conviction. So you didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
There can be a drop down as a negotiated plea. There can be a pardon later on. There's a lot of different avenues, which I think is why the statute allows discretion of the court to still do something, even if there has been a conviction ever. But to your point, in terms of protection of children, it didn't seem to me that there was ever any contesting by Ms. Cardenas-Garcia that she did the acts which constituted the child going into the custody of the state. Like the feces covered home with maggots and trash and not having the kids in school for 2 years and 51 animals and all of that stuff, the kind of things that give concern to returning children to certain environments. Am I correct that that was never contested, that there was responsibility for that?
Not that I recall. Correct.
Okay. I know I heard the bell, so I don't know if you want to continue on or if you want to turn it over to Ms. Abbott.
If I could just have one more minute, sure. Judge. I think the biggest thing in this case is when it comes to child abuse and neglect, you know, Justice Bell, you are correct. The court is always to look at the best interest of the child and the safety of the child. But this asks the district court, by clear and convincing evidence, to find that no physical or psychological harm will come to the child. That is not a burden it's under any other part of 432B. It's not an absolute bar to reunification. It's just a little bit higher barrier because of that underlying conviction, which we say, of course, under ever does exist. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kimberly Abbott, Children's Attorneys Project Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, on behalf of Real Party and Interest and the subject minor in this case, now 8-year-old ZK. First, I want to start off with the question that Ms. Rowe left off with Justice Bell, because I think it's important that we understand how the child welfare process works. I would disagree slightly with the answer that was provided about the court having to make those findings about best interest. In the course of a child welfare case, the Department of Family Services is given a very large amount of discretion. They are the ones that propose the case plan. They are the ones that set the conditions for return. Now, those get reviewed and approved by the court, and counsel can, you know, make arguments about that. But then it is ultimately the Department of Family Services that decides, has a parent sufficiently worked their case plan? Have they met their conditions for return? Is it time to return a child? And in many instances, the child is returned without a return hearing, without a consideration or an order from the court. So on a typical case, reunification is happening without any sort of findings from the district court. And so that's why in this instance, when we have a conviction, because the parent's conduct was so egregious that it rose to the level of a conviction, it adds this extra layer of protection. It takes some of that discretion out of the hands of the Department of Family Services, and it requires that the court is giving this extra scrutiny, that the court is making findings by clear and convincing evidence. So nearly all of petitioner's argument hinges on the court's opinion in Tiffy and other similar cases. The petitioner would have you find that Tiffy and those decisions pretty much bar the dependency court from continuing to apply this part of the statute in this type of situation. However, that would require the court to do four things, all of which I find a bit problematic. One, overlooking the fact that in the lower court, there was an agreement that this applied at one point in the case. It would also require that you significantly expand the reach of TIFI and other similar cases.
Oh, but if something is legally void, it doesn't exist. So how do we get around that?
But Your Honor, I think that in the criminal context, it doesn't exist. There are certainly examples in other contexts where it does exist. And I think the...
Do you have any cases that say that a dismissed criminal case, not a deferral under a statute, but a dismissed criminal case can be used in other contexts? It couldn't be used, for example, in a civil case, right, to establish liability because it would be void. It couldn't be used in that context.
No, Your Honor, I don't have a specific case, but my example was the deferred judgment statute, because if the deferred judgment statute, which is very clear under the law, does not rise to the level of a conviction, it's not considered a conviction. And in fact, in the statute itself, it uses language very similar to much of that that the petitioner cites about restoring the defendant to the prior position. And everyone agrees that that wasn't a conviction. But even in that instance, the statute is very clear that it can be considered a conviction for purposes of setting bail and for purposes of subsequent offenses. So
we don't have case law that would support that when a case is dismissed as opposed to deferred, right? So our legislature has said when a case is deferred, it can, the criminal act can still be considered for these particular things, but we don't have that here. All we have are cases all over that say that when a criminal conviction is vacated, it's void.
But if something that hasn't even been determined a conviction can be considered as a conviction for certain circumstances, how would it be that something that was indeed a conviction can then not ever be considered a conviction for any purpose? And so I think there's ceases to exist suggest moving forward, it doesn't exist. It doesn't necessarily suggest that going backwards, it's erased. Some of the case law that has been cited is different cases that where it's been expunged. That's not what happened here, and that's not what happened in TIFI. Also, there's a huge distinction in TIFI. TIFI was about the record sealing statute. The record sealing statute didn't have the ever language that's in this statute. The record sealing statute just says if there is a conviction. So at the time that Mr. TIFI applied to seal his record, that conviction did not exist. But this statute with the word ever, there's a difference.
Would you agree that that Ms. Cardenas-Garcia would have the right to go back to the district court and renew her request to have the court revisit whether she's, you know, done what she needs to do to overcome the presumption? I mean, she's not, it's not a one-time only thing.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Parents.
And when they went back, was there a request to do that or just to set aside the presumption, if you understand the distinction I'm getting?
Yes, I am. And I think it's a very important one. So just if I may, for a minute, going back to how the process works, there's that discretion that the department has when they're ready to reunify a child. Right. But there are two instances where they can't do that because they have to clear this bar. The domestic violence presumption that was brought up earlier by respondent and this instance. Right. So you have to go to court, get the court to say you've overcome that. But then it's still a separate issue. So even if at that presumption hearing, the petitioner had overcome the bar.
Right.
There was nothing in the record to suggest the department was ready to reunify her with her child. Right. So, and to this day, there's not evidence in the record that she's ready to reunify with her child. And so the issue is she could go back at any time that she believes she's ready and try to, again, meet that standard. She has not requested that at this point. So instead, we're here talking about extraordinary relief.
How do you respond to the argument that the domestic violence statute is written more broadly than the statute here?
So it's written differently as well, not just more broadly. It is actually called a presumption in that part of the statute that can be overcome. In our statute, we all refer to it very casually as a presumption, but it really is a bar. The child shall not be released. Now, it can be rebutted, so it's treated similar to a presumption. It is a higher standard, and so therefore, I think the legislature wanted a higher threshold. Also, I think part of the issue is child abuse, neglect, and endangerment comes in many shapes and sizes and in many varying degrees, right? We have cases where the house is a little bit dirty and that might be considered child neglect. And then we have this case where it was absolutely horrendous and the home was condemned. There's obviously a difference in how those two cases should be treated in the eyes of the law. So although the statute is predicated on there being a conviction, I don't believe it's about the conviction per se. The conviction is a signifier. It's a flag. It's a threshold to say to the court, this behavior has been so egregious that we need to give extra eyes to this, extra concern before we potentially.
As a matter of policy, I agree with you, but in interpreting the statute, that's just not what it says. And the legislature certainly could have written it in a different way to encompass any time that there's, you know, proven assertions of some kind of abuse or neglect, but what they said was conviction.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I would say in the lesser cases, there's not going to be a conviction pursued, right? The slightly dirty house, the more minor concerns, it's not going to rise to the level of criminal charges and a conviction being pursued. So that's the difference.
And you had two other points you were going to make. I wanted to know if you
and you don't have and I'm just about out of time. So yeah. I think I'll defer to my closing, which is at this point, DK respectfully requests that this court would deny petitioner's request for this extraordinary relief, would uphold the district court's decision, also upholding the provisions that are put in place to keep vulnerable children like him safe. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. You know, it strikes me, this is like a really bad and probably not very interesting Marvel movie, okay? Our position is very clear. Ms. Cardenas-Garcia has never been convicted of a felony in this case. A new timeline, if you want to call it that, was created when the conviction was vacated. So trying to find the point in time here where she was a convicted felon, isn't a convicted felon, is the wrong way to go about it. The conviction is void, so she never was a convicted felon. So for that reason, the statute on its face would not apply to her. All these public policy arguments, those are great. Everybody agrees children need protection. Sounds really good. The primary antibiotic against that is the judge. They still have to make a decision that she's completed her case plan, shown sufficient behavioral change before reunification is in the best interest of her and the child. So that always exists. We're talking about this extra hurdle that the statute imposes on people who are convicted, which is not my client. Leave it to the government to say that this intrusion just sets the bar a little higher. I'll respectfully disagree with that. Again, these are fundamental, important rights. The right of a parent to raise a child goes back to the time of our founding. What the Supreme Court recognizes is a particularly strong constitutional right. This is an intrusion against it. For that reason, it should be intruded on, if at all, as narrowly as possible, which is yet another reason not to read the word ever as broadly as my opponents would suggest doing, but instead do it narrowly, giving credence to both that interpretation of the statute as well as the agreement that the Clark County District Attorney made. You know, it's really interesting. On page 16 of our appendix, I would note the Clark County District Attorney actually supported my view of these events before they were against it when there was a Court of Appeals decision noted, and then the Clark County District Attorney said to the court at that time, well, we can't impeach someone with a prior felony because they don't have a felony because it was a drop-down deal and the conviction went away. So that's yet another context where somebody could have a felony and you ask, well, you know, did you ever have a felony or are you still burdened by it if it was voided or went away or was withdrawn? There was a time just not that long ago that the Clark County District Attorney would have agreed, well, that conviction was dropped down. It doesn't exist anymore. Now here we are having the opposite position presented. For all those reasons, I would suggest that this court's intervention is needed. This is the only way that the district court judge can be informed that this statute does not apply, do not have another presumption hearing. It does not apply to Ms. Cardenas-Garcia. That's no intrusion on the district court's ability to determine if she's ready to reunify with her child. It's simply saying that the statute poses this extra burden, does not apply to her. All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Any further questions? Good. All right. Thank you both. I appreciate it very much, your argument today, as well as the briefing in the case. And we will take it under advisement, and the court will be in recess.